welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, February 2nd, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we're sharing a clip from our most recent episode of the Courage My Friends podcast series, hosted on Needs No Introduction. In the last 4 years, the world's five richest men have doubled their wealth, while 5 billion people have become poorer. And where it may take over 200 years to end poverty, we may see our first trillionaire within only 10 years. This week, Lauren Ravon and Michelle Biss join host of the Courage My Friends podcast series, Resh Bidou, to talk about Oxfam's latest report, Inequality Inc., and the unprecedented rise in global inequality. Lauren Ravon is the executive director of Oxfam Canada, and Michelle Biss is the national director of the National Right to Housing Network. Here is a small clip from Inequality Inc., Corporate Power versus Public Action. Take a listen.
Michelle, welcome, and Lauren, welcome back. Thank you both for joining us. Global anti-poverty organization Oxfam International has just released its annual report, and the findings are disturbing. According to the report, we are now witnessing, quote, an economic inequality that is out of control. Lauren, paint us a picture. What are some of the vital statistics?
As we're releasing this report in 2024, this year, we're looking back at this decade since 2020, and this has been a decade so far that has been full of pain for most people around the world. The decade of a pandemic, of rampant inflation, food prices going up, war, climate chaos, climate emergencies. This is what's happening in this decade, where most people are really suffering and many people have gotten poorer. But this is also the decade where the wealth of the five richest men doubled. And so we're in this situation where the five richest men own a huge amount of wealth in this planet, and 5 billion people became poorer. So this report that Oxfam released, Inequality Inc., is really painting this picture of a decade of division where you have huge wealth concentration in very, very few hands and more people on the planet struggling to get by. And this is not kind of a coincidence that wealth is ballooning on one end and people are seeing the bottom fall out on the other end. Inequality is by design. It's not an accident. It's not inevitable. The super, super rich and their corporate corporations are funneling wealth towards the top and robbing the rest of humanity of the very resources they need to survive.
Right. And just as a point, so we have the five richest guys, and all men, by the way, and this is only the world's top five billionaires. Meanwhile, the world's billionaires collectively saw their wealth pile grow by over $3 trillion U.S. dollars, right? So we have the creation of a sort of a ballooning billionaire class as well.
Exactly. And I think sometimes talking about this scale of wealth seems abstract, and you could almost be tempted to say, well, who cares about these couple of billionaires, you know, these few men that own a lot, why focus on them? But the reality is that this is not like inequality of the past. Some of these men own as much wealth as, you know, an entire nation. And the fact that they hold this wealth, control the wealth, is not only that they have the resources and the money, but that they use this wealth to bend the rules of the game in their favor. And so this billionaire class that's emerging is working with corporate power to make sure that the rules around climate change, around wages, around food prices, around pharmaceuticals, everything is bent in their favor. And so it has this ripple effect throughout all of our lives. Every single person on this planet is affected by this hyper concentration of wealth. So you could think of someone like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Bernard Arnault, some of these men in the top five richest men in the world. You think, well, does this really impact me? Does it really impact rates of poverty in the country I live in the global South? It does. It has a direct impact because these people have made their wealth by squeezing profits out of workers, by making sure that they're able to trample the planet, pollute, dodge taxes. So there's this direct correlation between how hard it is for most of humanity and how good it is for them.
Now, inequality is nothing new in Canada. 10 years ago, Ed Broadbent, who sadly recently passed away, talked about the richest 20% owning nearly 70% of all wealth. But Michelle, what are we seeing now in Canada in terms of a wealth gap?
So it's quite wild to hear Lauren talk about the high levels of wealth by some of the richest people, because I work with mostly a lot of the people who are so struggling to make ends meet. And I hear about the enormous record amounts of wealth. And then I'm casting this in my mind as I think about this with what I'm hearing from people who, for example, are experiencing street homelessness, from people who are receiving social assistance rates. I mean, when you hear, for example, the small amount of social assistance that people receive, for example, from Ontario Works, from our general welfare system in Ontario, it is striking to think of these differences. And what I'm also seeing in terms of the inequality gap that is growing, it's also the way in which people who have enormous wealth, who have enormous power, really pushing against systems of accountability to be able to make that gap lessen and make things on the more even playing field.
And it's interesting how all over the world, we're seeing a replication of the same thing. The report notes that the richest 1% own 43% of all global financial assets. And again, that's being repeated regionally as well. Same statistic in the Middle East, Europe, Asia, North America, which of course includes US and Canada as well. The report is entitled Inequality Inc., an obvious play on words, in that it points to corporate monopolies as the main drivers of extreme inequality, as you were saying, Lauren. It even calls them inequality-generating machines. So, Lauren, how are corporations fueling this inequality crisis? Just give us an overview.
You noted that Oxfam has been publishing this report now. We do it annually, and we're more and more focused on the corporate dimension of this wealth accumulation and this growing inequality, because it's really this link between the ultra rich and their control over these huge corporations that's driving inequality. It is the corporate power, this corporate control over our planet, that's fueling the problems that we're seeing and are keeping people poor. So everything from squeezing workers, so really this huge push around wages. We know that in almost every country in the world, prices are going up faster than wages, and this is by design. We're seeing also corporations and their ultra wealthy owners dodging taxes and really bending tax rules in their favor. And every tax dollar that's dodged is a nurse that will never be hired, a school that will never be built. Mm-hmm. And they have become expert at dodging taxes and changing tax rules. We also know that this hyper large corporate sector is also pushing to privatize public services that people depend on for their survival. They see the public sector as this kind of essential service business where they could be making trillions of dollars in this industry if it's privatized. And so this push to privatize the public sector has real impacts for people while it channels wealth to rich shareholders. And then the last element I think of is understanding the link between this huge corporate power and the climate chaos that our world is experiencing. Not only do the super rich emit so much more carbon pollution than the rest of humanity, but they're also profiting from polluting industries and are pushing back fiercely against any form of regulations, any form of just transition that our planet needs to survive.
But we've had corporations and monopolies around for a long time. We have seen these trends that have been growing really during the neoliberal period of the last 40, now going on 50 years. However, the report says that this is a new era of monopoly. And I know you were speaking about this earlier, but what is different about now? What specifically is happening now?
This acceleration in the trend, that's really what has changed, is that yes, corporations have always had power in the societies where they're based, but the trend is accelerating. And I think you said the word monopoly, and that's where we see a major problem, is that there's this increased market concentration. For example, the pharmaceutical industry. You know, two decades ago, there might have been 60 pharmaceutical companies that were really running the market. Those have now merged into 10. So the 10 giant global big pharma firms. That's in the pharmaceutical sector, but we're seeing the same in big tech. If you think of, you know, the power that Google has around our capacity to even access information, same phenomenon in the food sector and the food distribution sector. And so these are essential sectors, knowledge, food, medication. There's such concentration that they're able to set the terms of the games in terms of the prices things are sold at. If there's less competitions, they have this monopoly power over pricing. We saw that during the pandemic. The pandemic could have ended much sooner if there had been equal access to vaccines, and there was not because of this big pharma control over price setting. And right now we're seeing the same thing with the inflation pushing so many people to go hungry. There's a huge monopoly control over everything from the seed sector to food distribution. So monopolies are really increasing the power of corporations at the detriment of everyone else. And this is accelerating.
Right. And it's interesting because, yes, we did see this around the vaccine, where it left continental Africa in a vaccine apartheid, talking about food as well. Two companies now control the majority of the global seed supply, which is exactly. Basically all food. Michelle, from your perspective, because you have long been an anti-poverty advocate, you are the national director of the National Right to Housing Network. Could you speak a bit more how poverty and inequality are being lived in Canada? You've got eyes on the ground in this. So what are the critical issues facing impoverished populations today?
Sure. Of course, I'm going to talk a little bit about the right to housing and homelessness in this country. To give you a little bit of the data behind this, it was back in 2019 that we got the estimate of 235,000 people in this country experiencing homelessness in any given year, and 25,000 to 35,000 people who may be experiencing homelessness on any given night. Now, I give you these statistics, and in some ways, they feel a bit cold because in reality, we know that women, especially gender diverse folks, experience mostly hidden homelessness. And so they're likely not captured in that statistic. And as Lauren mentioned, during the pandemic, we saw inequality grow. We saw poverty grow, despite some of this, you know, I will give a nod to the federal government, significant efforts, for example, with the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, the CERB benefit, which did have a really positive impact over that period of time. But we know that the experience of homelessness is increasing, of inadequate housing is increasing. We're hearing from cities and municipalities across the country that the number of people experiencing homelessness is significantly increasing. But the trend we really see in the Canadian context is that a lot of the efforts that we have been making through federal policy just are not making the cut. In fact, we've seen the Parliamentary Budget Officer, we've seen the Auditor General all note that our national housing strategy, so our main housing policy, just is not meeting it in terms of our goals of reducing poor housing need and eliminating homelessness. And I think that what is at the core of some of this is that the federal government is still relying on the private market to just sort itself out. What we see a lot is this context of financialized actors coming into the housing context and treating housing, which is a human right, which is protected by the National Housing Strategy Act, by the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, by our other human rights commitments. Though we see the right to housing protected, we see these financialized actors coming into the housing sector. We see some really detrimental financial practices that are just impacting people's lives. We actually just had our very first human rights review panel of a right to housing issue. It's the first of its kind. It's the very first time that we've had a federal access to justice claiming mechanism, something that is kind of like using the courts, but isn't quite using the courts. It's really, truly quite exciting. But the very first issue picked for this review panel was the financialization of purpose-built rental housing. So we actually just saw about 300 written submissions come from people with lived experience of housing precarity and homelessness across the country, as well as organizations. We saw as well a series of oral testimony that just wrapped up at the end of February, which spoke to the detrimental practices that are happening with financialization of housing, particularly for specific marginalized groups, including Black Canadians, including Indigenous persons, including women and gender diverse persons, persons with disabilities, because the reality is that these financial practices come into an area that is a need, that is a right, that is protecting people's lives. Housing is the difference between people's life and death. And we see these financial actors come in and treat housing as though it's a commodity using these financialized practices. And then the impacts on those rights holders, on people on the ground, can be tremendously devastating.
Let's just go a bit more into that, because in the report, they note that BlackRock is one of the big three asset fund monopolies. It is connected, I believe, to the housing crisis. And they just set up an office or one of their headquarters in Toronto just a couple of years ago. So we have this financialization of housing, as you're saying, and this wonderful now human rights response, which is very, very needed at this point, because all of this is happening at never before seen heights of a housing crisis that is also just out of control in Canada. So could you speak a bit more about what you mean by the financialization of housing in Canada?
Sure. So what I mean by the financialization of housing in Canada, and the way that this is defined internationally and particularly by human rights authorities, is the market is marked by the increased penetration of financial practices, logics, and strategies into a non-financialized sector. Someone described it to me one time, and this has always helped me picture financialization as major financial actors coming in and then operating housing off the side of their desks, right? Mm-hmm. They're operating it, not thinking that there are people living in housing. And then from this, you start to see actions such as increased evictions. There's a report from the Advocacy Center of Tenants Ontario, or ACTO, where since 2015, there was a dramatic increase in landlord applications to reclaim properties for their own personal use. This is often a tactic that especially financialized actors, but landlords, might use to evict tenants and turn over units for a higher income renter. There was such an increase that it rose by 85%. And then for rent evictions in Ontario, a 294% jump in rent evictions. I suspect that anyone listening to this podcast is not going to be surprised by this, quite frankly, at all. We all know people who have been affected by rent evictions, where we've seen landlords turning over units for a higher profit. A number of my colleagues and friends have gone through this. I'm sure many people's family members have personally gone through this. This context of treating housing as a commodity is something that I think folks are really, truly quite familiar with. But we also see this hesitancy, I will say, from the federal government to step in with forms of regulation. And this could be simple things. Well, I will say simple, but I think simple things in some ways, right? Measures of taxation, for example, that could be taken by the federal government. The Parliamentary Budget Officer released a report just last year, I believe, that said that Canada would collect $285.8 million of additional revenue from 2023 to 2027 just by removing the existing tax exemption for real estate investment trusts and subjecting those REITs instead to a 38% rate of statutory corporate income tax. So we see that right now, not only are we not regulating, but in some ways, we're giving these major financialized actors taxation benefits.
Now, housing, it's connected to everything, right? So we're seeing a crisis in housing. We're seeing a crisis in food security, obviously in income security. People are just feeling precarious all the way around. And as Michelle mentioned, this is especially hard hitting for gender diverse, for female populations, for racialized indigenous populations as well. And this is happening all over the world.
It's so helpful to have those specific examples for the Canadian context that Michelle is sharing on housing. And I just wanted to add on that this kind of privatization and financialization of the public service industry, something that we're not only seeing in Canada and we're not only seeing in housing, but we're seeing in many sectors. These corporate monopolies are really seeing essential services as money-making potential and an opportunity for them to generate huge profit and wealth for shareholders, not just in housing, but in areas like water systems. We know in many countries, people no longer have access to water because it has been privatized. In many countries in Africa where Oxfam works, the privatization of water systems is a huge impact. And the gender dimensions of that are huge in terms of not having access to water can mean that women then no longer have access to employment, to education, because a disproportionate amount of their time is spent trying to find water that should be freely and easily accessible to them. Same when it comes to childcare, elder care. We're seeing that, and we've seen this in Canada and also became very apparent during the pandemic, the privatization of elder care, so privatization of nursing homes, for example, in many countries around the world. That means that those services are no longer accessible to people. And who is taking on that burden if you can't pay for those services? It is mostly women and racialized people. And so the privatization not only funnels resources towards the top, but also robs people of the ability to have the services they need to then be engaged in society, whether that means having access to employment, having access to education, having access to leisure time. The less you have access to public services, the more you're struggling on a daily basis just to get by. And what is very frightening is that we see this impact in Canada, but we see it around the world. And in some countries, this is truly life or death if you are robbed of these public services. Michelle was talking about the fact that governments don't have the ability or have abdicated the ability to kind of tighten controls and taxation over these corporate entities. And this, again, is by design.
A small clip from Inequality Inc. Corporate Power versus Public Action from the Courage My Friends podcast series. To listen to the full episode, please tune in to Needs No Introduction. Needs No Introduction is available on Rabble.ca, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. The Courage My Friends podcast series is presented by Rabble.ca and the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College, and with the support of the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith announced her intention to introduce new anti-trans policies in her province. The policies would prevent trans youth under the age of 17 from using their correct pronouns in school, blocking them from receiving gender-affirming care, and block trans women from competing in women's sports. Rebel columnist Charlotte Dalwood explained how these dangerous policies will endanger the lives of trans youth in Alberta, writing, quote, "The point of making it impossible to be a trans youth is to make it impossible to grow up to become a trans adult. The point of killing trans youth is to wipe out the next generation of trans adults. The point of all this is to destroy trans people as a meaningful population. That is genocide." End quote. Staying in national news, the Canada Revenue Agency continues to allow charitable donations by Canadians to Israeli higher learning institutions. Eve Engler explains that many of these institutions are directly supporting the Israeli military and their campaign against the Palestinian people. Whether through training, housing, or other indirect support, several Israeli universities, including Tel Aviv University, Ben-Gurion University, and the University of Haifa, provide support to the Israeli military. Canadians who donate to these institutions are eligible to receive a tax donation receipt that they can claim on their annual tax form. This has been allowed to go on despite a Canada Revenue Agency policy that disallows donations in support of a foreign military. In labor news, a new report from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union is warning that migrant farm workers continue to face hazards and a lack of protection in the workplace. The report states that 98% of migrant agricultural workers who contacted their support centers reported not having had any information about health and safety in their workplace before participating in training provided by the union. The lack of health and safety training exposes workers to preventable injuries. Migrant workers are often powerless to stand up to their employers. Their work permits are often tied to specific jobs with specific employers, and if they are fired by their employer, they can be deported. Staying in labor news, there are growing calls for better supports for public sector psychologists in Quebec. At a time of growing demand for mental health services, Quebec public sector psychologists find themselves paid significantly less than their counterparts in other parts of the country. Rabble Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Madison Edward Wright reports that one reason for this is the lack of a large public sector union for psychologists. Dr. Karine Gauthier, the president and co-founder of the Coalition des Psychologues du Réseau Public Québécois, said that better working conditions and salaries for psychologists will ensure better access to health care, especially for high school and elementary school students. And finally, If Not Now Toronto is arguing that higher police budgets is not the solution to rising anti-Semitism. If Not Now Toronto is a local chapter of a Jewish movement working to end their community's support for the Israeli occupation. They are pushing back on the Toronto Police Service, who are using the recent rise in anti-Semitic activity as an excuse to ask for more public funding from the City of Toronto. In an op-ed shared on Rabble.ca, If Not Now Toronto states, quote, "It concerns us that with this blank check to fight anti-Jewish hate, their need for results will incentivize more militarized actions against protesters, such as the nighttime raids we've already seen, and will have an outsized impact on racialized communities." End quote. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
listening